20. But CBS loves her. There used to be a famous bar called Tail of the Cock on Ventura Boulevard in L.A. San Fernando Valley. I decided that would be the place to meet actor Wayne Rogers. His co-star on the sitcom House Calls, the wonderful Lynn Redgrave, had recently been fired, and CBS wanted me to replace her. They asked me, as a courtesy, to meet with Wayne. I was told to pick any place I wanted. What did I know? He didn't smoke or drink. I had a scotch and a full pack of Marlboro Reds on the table. That was our beginning. Shortly after hellos, Wayne said very pointedly, "I could have saved her, you know." I don't remember whatever else we talked about past his blunt opener. I only remember thinking, what a passive-aggressive asshole. What a cruel thing to say. Lynn Redgrave was hands down wonderful in House Calls for its first two seasons. She was just as talented and hard-working as Wayne Rogers, and she was in just as many scenes as he was. But that doesn't matter if your co-star wants to be the only star. Wayne had left the hit show MASH, tired of being a sidekick to Alan Alda. His aim was to be a leading man rather than part of an ensemble. He didn't like that Lynn Redgrave's name was billed over the title along with his. He also couldn't believe that she wanted to make as much money per episode as he did. But the request that Wayne found completely outrageous was that Lynn wanted to bring her infant daughter to work with her to continue nursing for a few more months. He seemed to feel strongly that Lynn's request to nurse her child for 20 minutes every 3 hours would topple the shooting schedule into chaos. He forced CBS to take action. Lynn tried to challenge it, but they fucking fired her ass. Now CBS wanted to hire mine. Even though it was obvious that Wayne Rogers didn't want me, or anybody else for that matter, CBS had already decided that I was the one. So I said yes. There was a cocktail gathering at the home of one of the producers thrown by CBS to welcome me to the show. Everyone, the entire cast, network executives, and all the writers and producers, was there. Monique was my date. Wayne stood before the gathering to introduce me and welcome me to the show. The first thing that I remember coming out of his mouth was a complaint. She was not my choice, but CBS loves her and says she's the new Carol Lombard. I was stunned. How could he say that while I was standing right there next to him? It was the most unwelcoming introduction that I had ever received. I wish I had responded, "Too bad you're not the new Clark Gable, but for some reason, unbeknownst to me, CBS likes you." 2 weeks after I arrived on the set, and while taping our second episode together, Wayne stood before the cast, staff, and crew of House Calls to announce that he was shutting down the show over a salary dispute. His. He never bothered to tell me first, which would have been appropriate, considering I was his co-star. We all packed up, emptying our dressing rooms, not knowing when or if we would be back. The show went dark for 2 months, but CBS continued to write checks to hold everyone to their contracts. I assume Wayne finally got whatever money he was asking for, because eventually we all went back to work. The week after we returned to film another episode, Wayne started to complain directly to me about my performance. He would take me to the side. "You're always angry. Can't you lighten it up? It's a comedy." "First of all," I said, "I'm only angry at you. It's called comedic anger," where I tossed my curls and slammed the door. He replied, "Well, I don't want Carol Lombard. I want Grace Kelly." I paused. "I am giving you Sharon Gless playing your adversary, Jane Jeffries." Wayne wanted some kind of elegant or sultry anger. I was doing the job. The director had no issues with my choices. Even so, Monique and I both wondered if I'd be fired from the show. Even though the show was still rated in the top 25, CBS pulled the plug. there would be no season 4. I believe they read the writing on the wall. Wayne would probably only have more demands and less tolerance for anything that took the spotlight off of him. At the wrap of season 3, I threw a party for the cast at my little house in Studio City. I thought Wayne would bring the party down, so I didn't invite him. I decided to be a class act and invite Lynn Redgrave instead. She was even classier. She accepted. Before she hung up, she said, "Why don't we do something funny? Stage something." "Like what?" "Let's have a fight, since you took my place on the show." I loved the idea. "Fantastic! I have a long driveway. Pull your car in so I can see your lights when you arrive." Everyone showed up, and the party atmosphere was in high gear. Around 11 p.m., I saw Lynn's car pull in. I announced, loud enough for all to hear, "Who's that?" The happy group stopped talking to look. I said, "Wait right here, everybody. I'm going to see what's going on." I went out my French doors, leaving them purposely wide open, and crossed the lawn to the driveway. Lynn got out of the car. We had never met before. I whispered to her, "Hi, Lynn Redgrave." She whispered, "Hello, Sharon Gless. Should we start?" I loved her instantly. She turned it up to a 10, shouting, "What did you just say to me?" I yelled, "Why in the fuck would I invite you?" She raised her voice louder. "I carried that show." I responded, "Carried the show? You can't act for shit." "Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I said that to a Redgrave." We went on and on, back and forth, until I shouted, "Get off my property! I'm calling the police!" Lynn followed me across the lawn and onto the deck. "Fuck you!" she screamed. I yelled back, "Fuck me! Fuck you!" I slammed the French doors in her face. I turned to the astonished crowd, now completely silent in my living room, and said, "Jesus, what a cunt!" Lynn stormed off of the deck. I let it stand for a really uncomfortable and long 15 seconds, and then I started laughing and said, "It's a joke, you guys." I opened the door and shouted to Lynn, "Get in here! I'm sick of entertaining these people." My guests all started laughing and clapping. Lynn was embraced back into the groove, and it became an even better party. We got stoned on the pot that actor David Wayne, who played the grumpy older doctor, grew himself in Pacific Palisades. We drank cocktails, told stories, and laughed our collective asses off. All without Wayne Rogers. Wayne had his own vision of the show. House calls became a good lesson for me in not taking complaints too personally. There are some things that no amount of effort can change. I can say this on his behalf. Wayne Rogers was a really good kisser. I will say this on her behalf. I admired and respected Lynn Redgrave. She should have won the Oscar for Georgia Girl. Watch it. You won't forget her. The one with the beard. I had a vision. I visit the set of a TV show. The face of the lead actress goes pale. She wants to see the upcoming script. She checks to see if her character has developed a bad cough, soon to be a fatal disease. My presence on her set means one thing. Replacement. I didn't want the reputation of being the troubleshooter actress, pinch hitter, or band-aid for a bruised show, or the last-ditch hope of baffled TV executives. I was beginning to feel that way. First, I was asked to step in for Angie Dickinson at the last minute when she dropped out of the TV movie Revenge of the Stepford Wives. I did it. I also got a call that the lead actress in the TV movie Hard Hat and Legs was being let go, and that the male co-star Kevin Dobson had requested that I take over the role. I did it. Then, CBS decided that I would be the one to replace Lynn Redgrave on House Calls for its final season. I did that too. And now, I was the one requested by TV executive producer Barney Rosenzweig to step in to replace actress Meg Foster on Cagney and Lacey. I did not want to do it. This was the third time I had been offered the role of Christine Cagney. I thought it was going to be the final time Barney Rosenzweig would be turned down by me. 7 years prior, Barney had had an idea for an ever-popular buddy-style motion picture, the kind that typically featured two male actors, such as The Sting, which starred Robert Redford and Paul Newman. However, his idea was to break with tradition and have the two leads be female. He entrusted the woman he was then dating, Barbara Corday, and her writing partner, Barbara Avedon, to come up with a script for the concept. Cagney and Lacey, a two-hour screenplay, was the result. After it made the rounds, a deal was struck with CBS for a TV movie. I knew both of the Barbaras from Turnabout, my earlier TV series on which they had been story editors. Barbara Corday was the first to suggest that I'd be a great choice to play Christine Cagney. Barney, who didn't care for Turnabout, disagreed, until months later when the two of them were screening Moviola, The Scarlet O'Hara War, in which I played headliner Carol Lombard. Barney pointed at the screen. "Now that's Cagney!" Barbara said, "That's Sharon Gless!" A call was made to offer me the role in the upcoming TV movie. Unfortunate timing. I had recently starred in a TV pilot, Palms Precinct, for NBC as a female cop. The network executives decided they didn't like my co-stars. They wanted to keep me as the lead and reshoot the entire script with new actors. I said no. It seemed like a large heap of bad karma to make. The idea of packing a rod again, as yet another police detective, held zero appeal. So I turned down the Cagney and Lacey TV movie. Besides, Universal Studios still had exclusive rights to me. Loretta Swit was then cast as Cagney, opposite Tyne Daly's Lacey. After the popularity of the TV movie, CBS offered Barney a series deal. Loretta Swit went back to MASH under contract, and Barney again offered the role of Cagney to me for the series. I was still under contract to Universal and unavailable. No deal. The contract system was being phased out, but my deal with the studio remained in place. They had retained me to co-star in House Calls. Monique marched from her bungalow office to the tower at Universal Studios. She persuaded them to put me under a series contract instead of an exclusive deal. If House Calls should be canceled, my contract would end as well. I would be free. And that's what happened. With no contract players left to shepherd, there was little reason for Monique James to stay with Universal. She chose to leave and walked away with a profitable pile of MCA Universal shares and me as her only client. Monique now became my personal manager. She had already bet her reputation on me. Now she was betting her future as well. It gave me a sense of security and the belief that with Monique, I had a future in this business, too. I was finally in a position where I could call my own shots, make significant income, and take on interesting roles, which, with Monique's help, is exactly what I hoped to do. I wanted to be in the movies. Barney Rosenzweig wanted me to be in his TV series. After airing 4 episodes of the first season of Cagney and Lacey, CBS programming chief Harvey Shepard told Barney that the show wasn't working, citing a lack of contrast between the two leads. Meg Foster would have to be replaced before they would consider giving the show another try. Barney went to New York, where the networks were gathering to announce their fall seasons. As soon as the executives left the CBS planning meeting, Barney found out that House Calls had been canceled and that I was now free of obligations to Universal Studios. I was out of work for the first time in my career. Even before the West Coast had heard the news of the cancellation, Barney was on the phone with my agent, Ron Meyer, to make an offer. Both Ronnie and Monique wanted me to meet with Barney to discuss the role of Cagney. I admit that I was hard to convince. I really wanted a role that was mine to originally create. I just wasn't interested in playing Cagney. Monique assured me that I didn't have to take the job, but convinced me that the polite thing to do would be to show up to lunch and hear Barney out. Show up we did. Monique and I went to Musso and Frank, Hollywood's oldest restaurant and my personal favorite hangout. Starting at age 5, I would go with Uncle Jack and sit at the counter for Musso's famous flannel cakes. Many entertainment deals have been brokered in the dark red leather booths at Musso's. When courting an actor or actress for a project, the network executives or producers usually trip all over themselves to make the actress feel fabulous. Then the actor, in turn, can demur modestly. That's what I was expecting to happen when, for the first time, I met Barney Rosenzweig and Dick Rosenblum, who was then the head of television production at Orion Pictures. Barbara Corday, by now Barney's wife, sat between the two men. I took my place at the table, not wanting to be there, but thinking that the motivated Mr. Rosenzweig would kiss my ass big time. I was ready to pretend that I was uncomfortably flattered and leave feeling terrific and not having to replace yet another actress in a shipwrecked show. That is not how it went. He never kissed my ass, at all. Instead, he attempted to educate me on how hard this acting job would be for me. He wanted me to understand that the hours would be long and the schedule grueling. It could get rough, he warned me. He wanted me to come on board with my eyes wide open. I was offended that he assumed I had no work ethic and was not familiar with long hours. I proceeded to explain that I had already been on 4 series, the lead on 2, and that long hours and hard work were not strangers to me. Still, he persisted in explaining the sacrifices that would have to be made by me to play Christine Cagney. It's a great restraint for me not to shout, "Who do you think you're talking to?" I stopped listening. He stopped talking. He crossed his arms. What a jerk, I thought. I leaned back. I looked at my watch that I wasn't wearing. Was this over yet? Dick Rosenblum had been silent through this entire exchange. Seeing that it was now a standoff between two children, he jumped in. He very nicely told me the things I expected to hear. He listed all the reasons I had been invited to lunch and why I was the most desirable choice for the role and always had been. He cheered me up. I turned all my attention to him and didn't make eye contact with Barney Rosenzweig again for the rest of the lunch. It ended cordially, with the understanding that I would seriously consider the kind offer. We said our goodbyes. Once we were in the parking lot, Monique once again suggested that I should consider the part. My frustration grew. You said all I had to do was have lunch with these people. I don't want to do another series. I want to be in the movies. Monique paused, then wisely attempted to diffuse my anger. Well, of course, that's what we all want for you, sweet pea. She was lying, and I knew it. But in the interim, I think this might be an interesting role for you. Not in the mood to give an inch, I stood resolute. I don't want to do it. I don't like the guy with the beard. His name is Barney Rosenzweig. Whatever. The film Fairy Godmother must have been hovering over that parking lot behind Musso and Frank, because days later, I was invited to meet with the director of a new movie, a crime thriller called The Star Chamber, starring Michael Douglas. They were looking for an actress to play his wife, Emily. I thought, here it is! My chance to break into the movies! I wanted to give it my best shot in every way possible. I arrived at director Peter Heim's office wearing a pale yellow silk dress with yards of material belted at the waist. I borrowed it from my wardrobe rack at Universal. I had given the designers my personal color chart, the results of a session I'd had with Suzanne Cagill, author of the 1980s phenomenon Color, the Essence of You, and they would buy my wardrobe items based on it. The creamy yellow dress was working well, almost like a hypnotic suggestion. After 2 hours, he said, "Do you want the part?" I responded, "Yes, but don't you want me to read for you?" He said, "No, I just want you to wear that dress in the film." My God, I got a role in a movie! And with Michael Douglas, no less! I was the only woman in an all-male cast! My longest scene in the movie was with Michael and me in bed together, post-coital. Both of us were to be bare-chested, me lying on top of him. The direction in the script read that the camera shot was to slowly pan up my naked back from the top of my buttocks to the back of my head and then, finally, to my face. Not even the wardrobe department could help me out with flattering colors when it was bare skin. I worked out at the Y for 3 hours every day. If my complete back was going to have a close-up, I wanted to make sure it looked great. It was the high heat of summer, and the air conditioning in the studio had to be turned off so the microphones didn't pick up the sound of it blowing. I had to lift my considerably large breasts onto Michael's bare chest before the director called, "Action!" I had a long monologue about how I was concerned that something bad was going to happen to him. The camera panned up my bare back and around to my face as I spoke. We had to do the scene many times for each of the camera angles. Between takes, there would be an audible suction sound as I peeled my breasts off of Michael's chest, leaving behind a small pool of sweat on his skin. It was humiliating for me, but never because of Michael. He always averted his eyes until I was in place for the next take. He was a true gentleman. There was no spark of sexual energy between us at all. Nothing. I didn't know if I felt relief or disappointment. Before it was over, Michael and I had lunch together. I took the opportunity to ask his opinion about Cagney and Lacey. The first episode was supposed to start shooting right after we finished filming the Star Chamber. "Michael, is it wise for me to do this TV show? I now have this feature with you. Is it a mistake to do another TV series?" He asked me, "Do you remember a TV show called The Streets of San Francisco?" I laughed. "Yes." He said, "Don't give up the TV show. I'll leave it at that." Michael had given me good advice. The Star Chamber was no career changer. Cagney and Lacey would forever be my signature role. XXII. Champagne and Chagrin. Tyne Daly is the most generous actress I've ever worked with, and I've shared the screen with many actors and actresses since 1972. I'm proud of the fact that we co-starred in the first television drama that had two women as the lead characters. It came pretty close to not happening. Tyne did not want to lose Meg Foster, who had played Cagney for the first 6 episodes. They ate lunch together every day. She went to bat for Meg at CBS, even dangling the possibility of leaving herself. It was an honorable thing to do for a co-star. But CBS wasn't in the business of giving out merit badges for loyalty. They wanted ratings. The numbers were showing that Cagney and Lacey was not working in its current form. When I was considering joining the show, my agent Ron Meyer had the first 6 episodes sent to my house for me to watch. I wanted to see for myself what wasn't working for the viewers and for CBS. I put a bottle of J&B and a bucket of ice in the TV room and sat down to watch. It was clear after 2 episodes. The leads were too similar. Meg was playing Cagney too close to the way Tyne Daly was playing Lacey. There had to be more pronounced differences between them, other than the fact that one was a single career woman and the other was married with children. I had already starred in 4 series, 2 in which my name had been billed above the title. The viewing audience was familiar with my face and name after having seen me week after week on Switch and House Calls. Tyne was a respected working actress with a number of movie roles and had been a notable guest star in dozens of TV series, but had yet to star in one of her own. Where an actor's name appears in the opening titles matters. It shows the importance of your place on the show and your status in the television industry. Even though our roles on the show were equal, I had already established my name in television. Tyne saw it as her right to have top billing, and I couldn't blame her for it. She'd already played the part in the successful TV movie, and for the first 6 episodes of the series, her name appeared before Meg Foster's. It all came down to Barney Rosenzweig. He was the executive producer, and the decision on the billing order was his, according to his contract with CBS. Wisely, he preferred to not play that card, even though he'd been the one who decided that Tyne Daly would have top billing for those first 6 episodes with Meg. He didn't want to lose either Tyne or me, and he didn't want to resume filming the series with one of us being completely pissed. He was also trying to judiciously acknowledge and balance the requests and even the ultimatums of CBS executives, agents, managers, creative staff, and business partners. Not a task for the faint-hearted. He asked Tyne to give me a call from San Francisco, where the cast had assembled for the CBS presentation of the upcoming season to TV station owners from across the country. Everyone was there except for her co-star. I had not yet agreed to play the part and didn't realize that there was a problem. I answered the phone, but I didn't recognize Tyne's voice. In the 6 episodes I had watched, Tyne had used a strong, grew-up-in-Boston-now-lives-in-Queens accent. She did it so believably, I expected actress Tyne Daly also spoke that way. When the phone rang, I wasn't sure if it was really Tyne or if it was a prank call. That didn't go over well with her. She told me that she'd only made the call at Barney's request, which didn't go over very well with me. Tyne called Barney and said that I had frosted her on the phone. I called Barney and reported that Tyne couldn't have been more cold to me. It seemed to be the end of the road. But there was growing pressure from Barney, my agent, Tyne's agent, and the supporting cast. So Tyne was pressed to reconsider her position of not caring about the blonde actress of whom she, quote, had never heard, end quote. The day before my birthday, Memorial Day weekend, 1982, I was at the Department of Motor Vehicles trying to renew my driver's license that would expire the next day. I decided to call Tyne. I wasn't sure what I would say. I only knew I had to call her. I went to the payphone. Luckily for me, she answered. Tyne, I'm standing at a payphone in the middle of the DMV. I'm sorry for the noise, but my license is about to expire because tomorrow is my birthday. I'd like for us to talk, the two of us, with no one else around. Would you like to come to my house tomorrow? Kindly, she said, sure. She arrived with a bouquet of birthday balloons and a couple of bottles of champagne. I got out 2 glasses, we sat on my living room floor, and proceeded to get smashed together. I liked her very much. I told Tyne that I completely understood all the reasons she wanted to be billed first. She'd already played the role twice. I said that, unfortunately, it would be a bad career move for me. To be billed in second position would be a step down. She was very gracious, and we were both sad that it probably wouldn't work out. I wished her well. I truly meant it. We both thought that would be our first and only get-together. Barney Rosenzweig wasn't about to allow his dream to be over. He came up with a billing idea. The compromise was that both our names would appear on the screen at the same time, side by side. Each week, the opening credits would alternate. One name would be on the left side of the screen, but slightly lower than the name on the right side of the screen. The next week, we would flip. Our agents and Barney all agreed that it worked. Tyne and I put our feelings about billing into remission. It was on. I was to be the new Christine Cagney. Before I had even read one word of a script or set foot on the set, I was shipped out by CBS to do a press junket for Cagney and Lacey. Tyne and I were to do the Chicago-Atlanta tour. In both cities, the stars do every local TV show, morning, noon, and night, every newscast, radio show, and print interview that you can squeeze into a couple of days to promote the show, and in our case, introduce me as the new Cagney. As it turns out, actress Betty White was on my flight from L.A. heading to Chicago to promote a show as well. While walking to our gate, we passed two nuns wearing full habits. One of them wore large gold hoop earrings, which protruded from the front of her wimple. I pointed it out to Betty. Nuns never wore earrings, at least not during my Catholic upbringing years. Can you believe that, Betty? Gold hoops! You're right, Betty acknowledged. Pearls would have been better. Flawless timing. 8 decades of it. I arrived at the downtown high-rise hotel in Chicago the same time as Tyne, who was traveling with her then-husband, George Stanford Brown. As we checked in, I was given a room on the 6th floor. Tyne was given a room on the 22nd floor with a good view. On the Universal Studios lot, it was always well known that the higher the floor, the higher the rank. I shared that information with Tyne and George. I told them I'm not trying to take it personally. As I got off of the elevator at floor 6, I said, "You'll be sorry when the fire breaks out." They both laughed. Later, Tyne and George met me at my room on my lower floor to all go out to dinner together. When our elevator doors opened at the lobby level, I couldn't believe what was happening. As if I had conjured them, fire trucks with their lights flashing were parked in front of the hotel. Long, thick hoses lay across the lobby floor. There was a fire in the kitchen. I looked at Tyne and said, "Don't fuck with me." She burst out laughing. I knew we would get along. When we returned to L.A., it was time to start shooting the new season. I would be, once again, the new kid on the block. I was used to the feeling, but this time it came with the tremendous pressure of being the person who was coming on board to supposedly fix what had not worked with Tyne and Meg. CBS had made it quite clear that this would be the last chance for Cagney and Lacey. The first script was sent to my house, and I read it through, hoping to get a handle on this character of Christine Cagney. Tyne called me at home. She suggested that the two of us read the script out loud together before anyone heard us at the table read the next morning. It was a great idea and a big relief for me. Tyne arrived at my house with another chilled bottle of champagne, and we read the script 5 times until we could feel the relationship between our characters start to solidify and we both felt comfortable. The full cast and the writers were all present the next morning. I didn't know a soul. No one knew that Tyne and I had rehearsed it the night before. When we finished, everyone in the room applauded, and executive producer Barney Rosenzweig stood up and said, "And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how it's done." It took 3 seasons on the show for me to grasp how Cagney and Lacey was changing the national conversation about what was possible for a woman in the 1980s. Christine Cagney appeared before America's TV viewers with her own Manhattan loft apartment, a career as a police detective with a female work partner, dating men on her terms with no intention of becoming someone's wife. Cagney and Lacey introduced mainstream America to issues that were important to women: financial independence, professional ambition, modern motherhood, women's health care, equality in marriage and the workplace, and mutual respect and justice for all, regardless of gender. The brilliance of the show was that Christine and Mary Beth were not activists, feminists, or even very politically vocal. They were not best friends. They were two women whose lives depended on one another. What was true about the close relationship between Christine and Mary Beth would eventually become the case for Sharon Gless and Tyne Daly. Even though the press always seemed determined to paint the two of us as adversaries, that picture couldn't have been farther from the truth. If any reporters had stopped by the set at 2 a.m. after any given 14 to 17 hour day of filming, they would have seen a production lot that was totally dark except for my trailer. If they knocked on my door, they would have found Tyne and me rehearsing our scenes for the next day, just like we'd done together before our very first table read. We picked my trailer to rehearse because I kept the open bar. Long after the crew, writers, and supporting cast had gone home, we would rehearse until the lines felt natural and crucial and often humorous. I was always looking for the laughs, especially in a drama. We were two actresses carrying the lead roles in a show that would live or die on our chemistry together. I don't think actors alone can take credit for chemistry. It's either there or it isn't. Barney Rosenzweig held the bigger vision of what the show could become. He brought on the best writers he could find. He gave us a brilliant supporting cast. He hired a variety of directors who kept it fresh on screen. And he let Tyne and me build a relationship that viewers cared about through 6 years of Cagney and Lacey. Best Intentions. You can count on New Yorkers. As a Californian, I had always heard that New Yorkers didn't give a shit about anybody but themselves. I was wrong. Stories of great heroism rise to be told from the streets of Manhattan. 9/11 eradicated any remaining stereotype that they're only out for number one. Tyne and I had our own experience with the quick, heroic response of New Yorkers in 1983. We were trying to film an addition to the main titles of Cagney and Lacey on the busy streets of Manhattan. The idea was to have a guy act as a purse snatcher, grab the handbag of an unsuspecting woman walking down a city sidewalk, coincidentally near Christine and Mary Beth. Of course, the two of us fly into action, chasing down the perp. The actress playing the victim agreed to use her own purse. The young stuntman playing the purse snatcher was set and ready to go. The camera was placed down the block on a production van to capture Tyne and me in pursuit. It was meant to happen all in 5 to 10 seconds at the most. On the first take, the stuntman grabbed the purse and started to run. Two or three New Yorkers, unaware that we were filming, took off after him, grabbed the purse, and knocked the stunt guy to the sidewalk. Ow! The would-be heroes were completely baffled when Tyne and I ran up behind them shouting, "No! No! No! We're filming a scene!" We tried a few more takes, but every time at least one real New Yorker would witness the purse snatching and tackle the beleaguered stuntman. The poor thief was exhausted from trying to escape the valiant New Yorkers, and the actress's purse was a tattered mess by the time she got it back. We never got the shot. We ended up having to stage a chase through a subway car with paid extras in all the seats. Then Mary Beth and Christine emerged from the subway stairs with a perpetrator in handcuffs. A stage flasher standing at the top of the stairs opens his raincoat in front of us. Cagney gives him a once-over, like, "What are you hoping to do with that?" No real New Yorkers jumped in to save us from a flasher. I guess that's just par for the course in a Manhattan workday. Nothing to see here, folks. Keep it moving. Are you Irish? My very first episode on Cagney and Lacey revolved around a police colleague being killed in the line of duty. Mary Beth ushers Christine into the women's restroom in the precinct, the only place they could speak privately, to break the news. I had decided that Chris Cagney, being of Irish descent and the daughter of a former cop, would be outraged by the tragedy. That's how I played it, full-out emotion. I tore up the bathroom. I kicked in the side of the trash can, threw some props, and slammed my hand against the stall door. My nose ran. Jane Fonda had a runny nose, and they shoot horses, don't they? She won an Oscar for that movie. I was out to prove that I was much more than a comedic blonde and can hold my own in an hour-long drama. I was an actress with acting chops, even if it meant crushing my foot by kicking the trash can. My ow, ow, ow was not in the script. Tyne stood motionless, watching my reaction until I was finished. Later that day, I said to Tyne, "You know, I think that was a bit much. Too over the top." Then I confessed my true motivation for my titanic performance. I wanted you to think I was a good dramatic actress. Tyne, without a moment of vacillation, said, "I thought you were great. I just stood there and let you do it." She sure did. It was a brilliant choice, a powerful performance on her part, without moving a muscle. Any embarrassment I felt wasn't compounded by Tyne. It was a relatively painless, notwithstanding my throbbing toes, but permanent lesson. Character before ego. Always. Well, almost always. I really liked Chris Cagney. She was selfish, which made her fun to play. She had a big dream, to be the first female police commissioner. She had a loft in Soho. She loved the city, playing cards with the guys and sleeping around. She planned to stay single. It worked for her. Chris Cagney wasn't beyond taking credit, cheating a bit, or turning the tables to climb the ladder. She was insistent and petulant, sarcastic and unapologetic. She was volatile and unexpectedly vulnerable. She was flawed. She loved to drink a lot. She did everything full out. There wasn't another female character on national TV that was anything like Christine Cagney. I started to feel at home in her skin. What I didn't feel comfortable with was the perception of Cagney by the two most influential women on the show, Barbara Corday and April Smith. Barbara Corday and her writing partner Barbara Avedon had written the pilot TV movie for Cagney and Lacey. Barbara Corday was also Barney Rosenzweig's wife. They were a Hollywood power couple. April Smith was the head writer for the series. Both women were talented. But talent doesn't equate with being correct in all circumstances. I've always been willing to listen to those in authority. I don't always agree. I had accommodated their choice of hairstyle for Cagney, long in length with flipped-out layers, a popular look that year. The look was too Farrah Fawcett knockoff for my taste, but what the fuck, I can collaborate. Even the mid-calf petticoat skirts and form-fitting tops could be tolerated, though it all seemed so wrong for this ambitious woman who wanted to be taken seriously by the guys in the precinct. One evening, as filming wrapped for the day, Barbara Corday and April Smith invited me to join them at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in Beverly Hills for drinks. Tyne always went directly home to be with her two teenage daughters, Elizabeth and Catherine, if we weren't rehearsing, so I didn't think anything about being asked to join them without her. We sat in a private booth. After the obligatory niceties, the two of them teamed up and spilled the real reason for our happy hour conclave. They were both in agreement that I was not playing Christine the right way. That is, not to their specific expectations. They explained that it was their third opportunity to get it right, after Loretta Swit and Meg Foster had played Cagney. I set my drink down. "Am I being fired?" Barbara continued on, not addressing my question, explaining how she had envisioned Cagney to be a very cool character, a woman who kept a lid on it. April nodded in agreement. "You're playing her with such anger, Sharon," Barbara concluded. She thought that Cagney should keep all emotion close to her bulletproof vest. Whatever the outcome, I decided to speak up for myself. "Excuse me, Barbara, are you Irish?" With a quizzical look, she shook her head. "And you, April, Irish?" Another no. "Well, I am. I'm playing an Irish cop. who's the daughter of an Irish cop. I don't know any Irish people who are cool and calm. We get pissed. We show it. But thanks for telling me. I'm pretty sure we didn't stay for dinner after that. I wasn't certain what my future on the show would be. I thought I was being fired. I called Monique James from a nearby payphone and told her of the complaint. She assured me that she would get to the bottom of it. Monique placed a phone call to Barney, who was caught off guard that Barbara and April thought they could give one of his leading ladies their personal negative feedback on the side. He told Monique that I was doing great and to completely ignore their helpful insights. He very much appreciated that I had taken the character to a new place, one that had completely contrasted with what Meg or Loretta had done before. He said he liked that I could siphon out a laugh through a look or an inflection on the written line. This was not the first time I had heard complaints about my performance, nor the first time I'd been close to being fired. There was a lot riding on my being able to deliver this character. If I couldn't create a fresh and interesting contrast and chemistry between Cagney and Lacey, the show would be finished. I knew that as long as Barney liked what he saw on the screen, I was safe. But the first television drama starring two women was ripe for criticism. An article in TV Guide referred to Tyne and Meg as dykes. After I joined the show, one male critic wrote, "The blonde is from the Copacabana School of Acting." I was devastated. One day I asked Tyne, "Who's the enemy here?" She told me, "Fear." I understood that she meant fear of two strong women in leading roles. Our show was cracking the glass ceiling of TV dramas in the early 1980s. Weeks later, an actor from House Calls, Mark L. Taylor, came to the set to visit me. He handed me a rolled-up piece of paper tied with a ribbon. I opened it. It was a graduation certificate with my name on it from the Copacabana School of Acting. I framed it and hung it in my trailer for 6 years. I began to assert myself in other ways. I defied my female producers. Cagney was not a woman who was going to risk having her 3-inch boot heel get caught in a ruffled hemline while chasing a perp down a stairwell. I talked to the wardrobe department. I wanted jeans or trousers, sneakers or flat-heeled boots and oversized sweaters and men's sport coats. I wore a better bra to subdue my breasts. I didn't want people to tune into the show to see the blonde cop with a leotard top and a huge rack bouncing down an alley in a Laura Ashley skirt. I had my long hair cut off. My hairdresser, Carolyn Elias, put it in pin curls, and I sat under a dryer every single morning. It ended up looking like naturally curly hair, soft, but with an attitude. Cagney came to life. She talked tough and wore pink. Tyne was also very open to me playing Christine Cagney in a whole new way. I think it gave her some fun new energy to play off of as Mary Beth. It took a lot of guts on my part, but one day, early on, I asked Tyne for a favor. Would she mind if Cagney could burst through the door first, guns drawn? Cagney wasn't a careful person. She would jump in, even if doing so was risky. Tyne was reluctant and confided to me that she didn't like it for obvious reasons. But she generously agreed, saying, "If you feel that is right for your character, then fine." I loved her so deeply at that moment. She knew I wasn't trying to take attention from Lacey. I was trying to establish Cagney. I appreciated that she could see it that way. It made sense to me. Mary Beth had a husband and 2 sons at home to think about. She was a wonderful cop, but she had more to lose because she was a wife and a mother. She wasn't willing to take risks without consideration. Cagney wouldn't take the time to assess a risk. Often she was wrong. Okay by me. We began to work out the details and eccentricities of our characters. Mary Beth drank her coffee from a ceramic mug. Christine always chose a styrofoam cup. She didn't want the permanence. She wanted to be able to pick up and go at a moment's notice. Before we went out, Mary Beth would wash and dry her cup. Cagney would toss hers in the trash. A ceramic cup made by a fan with Cagney inscribed on it was sent to the show for me. Christine would never use it for coffee. However, it sat on her desk holding pencils. It now sits on my desk at home holding my pens. At one point in the first season, Barney told Tyne and me, "You are now the custodians of your characters. You must keep track of their experiences, and if something feels untrue, speak up." We did speak up. Often. Barney began to call it the cuckoo clock syndrome. I would go to his office to say that a line or an idea didn't work for Cagney. He would call in a writer and have it fixed. As soon as I would leave, Tyne would appear with a grievance about what business in the script was not right for Mary Beth. As actresses, we knew that we were nothing without great dialogue from our writers. But as the custodians of our characters, we felt obligated to make them as real as possible. After Barney would watch the footage of what had been filmed that day, I would stop him on his way back to his office. "How are the dailies?" If he said fine, I'd be infuriated. Fine? Fine isn't good enough. Barney had a smart litmus test for creating a really special show. He would say to Tyne and me, "Give me 1 good minute a day. 1 minute where you make me laugh or cry or surprise me. Do that, and we will have 7 good minutes per picture, more than enough to make a terrific episode." He liked to be taken off guard or delighted by an extra layer of something. If it took 7 days to shoot an episode, that would mean that 7 minutes of each hour-long show, actually 46 minutes due to commercials, would stand out in a powerful way. I had my own litmus test for a good performance. My nipples. My favorite scenes were always the ones of Christine and Mary Beth talking through issues in the Jane, the women's bathroom at the precinct where the two could let down and be themselves. The scenes were often raw and were loaded with energy, humor, and rage. I always knew when we hit it, my nipples would get hard. "That was good. Feel this." Putting her hands on my breasts, I told Tyne, "If we're really clicking, I get chills and my nipples go up." After that, whenever she and I would do one of those scenes together, she'd jokingly ask, "How'd we do?" and touch the front of my shirt to find out. The hours at the studio and on set were grueling, and exhaustion was predictable. However, the reviews were very favorable. We felt good about what we had done. Close to the end of season one, Barney sent Tyne and me to Washington, D.C., to make an appearance at an event for NOW, the National Organization for Women. Tyne and I would appear in person, and the audience would get a sneak preview of the latest episode of Cagney and Lacey. That was the plan. Unfortunately, the episode was delayed in editing and couldn't be shown. As a replacement, Barney put together a collection of our best scenes from the 22 episodes in chronological order. Tyne and I sat in the back of the dark room watching Barney's presentation. By the end of the film, we both had our hands over our eyes and were sharing the same thought. Holy shit! What happened to us? The succession of clips was like observing 2 fresh flowers open up and blossom fully and then begin to curl up at the edges, wilt, and die. We had both aged at least 22 years in our first season together on Cagney and Lacey. Even if we didn't feel the exhaustion of the high-pressure shooting schedule, it definitely showed on our faces on film. What Barney had warned me about at Musso and Frank was reality. We wrapped up our first season, expecting to see each other in 3 months for the next one. It was the summer of 1983. Tyne went home to her daughters and husband, and I went off to shoot a TV movie, Hobson's Choice, with Richard Thomas in New Orleans. I asked Monique to keep me busy with work because I would feel restless after even 1 week off. When I got back to my hotel room one evening after shooting on location in the French Quarter, there was a message from Barney. A short time later, he called again. I could tell by the sound of his hello that this wouldn't be a happy phone call. Cagney and Lacey had been canceled. Over the phone, we got drunk together. He in a Manhattan bar phone booth at Frankie's and Johnny's, and me in the Big Easy. Nothing about this news was easy. Raised from the Dead. More than two decades before Twitter was born, before the internet was available to all, social media brought back Cagney and Lacey. It wasn't viral. It was a nationwide campaign through snail mail, thought up by Barney Rosenzweig. After CBS had canceled our show, a messenger showed up at Barney's front door with three huge boxes full of thousands of letters from viewers. They were letters of protest from fans who were outraged that their new favorite show had been canceled. Barney called both Tyne and me to see if we had also received similar letters. We had. Lots of them. He sent a driver to each of our houses to get our mail. Barney decided to send a letter to each viewer who had taken the time to write. But in a moment of genius, he added a last paragraph. It is my perspective that no one in power at CBS will even read your letter. My suggestion, should you still be agitated about this matter, is to write to your local newspaper, as well as the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, on the theory that network executives may not read their mail, but they do read their newspapers. With the help of an assistant, thousands of envelopes were hand-addressed and the letter was sent out. It was impossible to guess what, if anything, would be the result, but within weeks, both the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times published articles about the unprecedented volumes of mail they had received regarding the cancellation of Cagney and Lacey. Huge bags of letters were shipped to CBS from newspapers around the country. The viewers had come through for us. They loved the show as much as we loved making it. Barney's grassroots idea was growing. A month later, the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences announced four Emmy nominations for CBS's canceled show, Cagney and Lacey. Tyne and I were both nominated for Best Actress in a Drama. There was one for Best Dramatic Series and one for Sound Mixing. USA Today came out with a large photo of Tyne and me as Cagney and Lacey, and the headline, CBS Canceled, Cops Number One. Good Morning America flew us to New York for a segment on their show about our Emmy nominations, despite the cancellation. Other media outlets taunted CBS executives for prematurely canceling what was apparently a hit show. We were the only CBS show to feature two female leads. The summertime ratings had been great, rocketing to number one. And we had Emmy nominations and millions of dedicated viewers who were pissed off. CBS's programming chief, Harvey Shepard, the very man who had decided on the cancellation 6 months prior, was now receiving an avalanche of mail. He called a meeting with Barney. The end result was history-making. Raised from the dead by viewer demand, Cagney and Lacey was granted another season. Thanks to the inconvenience of the cancellation, Tyne and I became the highest-paid actresses on TV at that time. We never thought to ask what the men made. The fans got it done by typewriter or pen and paper and a 20-cent postage stamp. Power to the people! And a very personal thanks to all the fans of the show who wrote in from me. Twenty-six. frankly, the best. Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs, Coney Island. They've been around for 105 years. They are New York history. They are part of my history as an actress. Every year, I would work out with great discipline during our hiatus from Cagney and Lacey. I would return for the beginning of the shooting schedule thinner and toned. Even my face would look different. I had a special trainer come to the house for an hour every day to help me do something called face pumps, a ridiculous-looking set of exercises to keep your face firm and a bit more youthful. In the world of television drama, very few scenes are shot in sequence. It takes hours for the cameras, sound system, and lights to be set up in a location, and for the cast and crew to rehearse their shots. To be cost and time effective, all the scenes that happen in the precinct would be filmed in one group. All of Mary Beth and Harvey's scenes at home would be shot together. Every indoor shot may look like a New York police station or a brownstone apartment in Queens, but it actually all took place in the Lacey Street Studios in downtown Los Angeles. We'd start each new season by flying to New York City to film exterior scenes that would be peppered throughout the year's episodes. This was cost-effective for production, but held some challenges for Tyne and me. Many of the scripts weren't written in full yet. Tyne and I had to depend on the writers to tell us exactly why we were dodging between cars on Broadway. Expediency? Chasing a perp? What? It would be midsummer when we shot all of these outdoor scenes in New York, often hot and humid, even at night. I would ask wardrobe for lightweight clothing. The problem was, months later in Los Angeles, when we had to match the New York scenes, I could not fit into my already established costume. By the next season, the wardrobe department had figured out a way to camouflage my predictable weight gain. From then on, when filming our New York scenes, they put us in coats, hats, scarves, and boots. Let me repeat, it was August, in New York, in the heat, in 93% humidity. One muggy Manhattan evening, I was on location for our very first shot of the season. It took place on a street corner, with me dressed in a winter coat and knee-high leather boots. The scene called for me to chomp on a hot dog as I walked down the street. I asked the prop master, "Where did this hot dog come from?" He pointed down the block. "The cart on the corner." It obviously wasn't a Nathan's hot dog. I had heard stories about what gets packed in hot dog skins of the cheaper variety. Chicken trimmings and ground-up kidneys weren't going in my stomach if I could help it. At least Nathan's dogs were all beef. I decided to complain. I said, "I can't eat this. I need a healthier hot dog." Jesus, I had some nerve. I went so far as to tell the director that I wouldn't be filming the scene until I had a Nathan's quality hot dog. The executive producer was summoned to the set. Looking at his watch, Barney asked me, "What seems to be the problem?" I said, "I have no clue what's in this hot dog. I want a Nathan's." He nodded and then said, "There is no Nathan's nearby. It's late at night and we need to shoot the scene. Eat the hot dog." This wasn't like him. He always made everything happen for us, whatever Tyne and I wanted. In TV production, time is money. Barney wasn't going to hold up shooting for an hour while someone ran to Coney Island for a frankfurter. So, risking my very health for the cause, I swallowed my pride and the spare parts dog from the corner cart. Wasn't that bad. There were no subsequent side effects. To make amends and get me to smile again, Barney somehow got the Nathan's mascot, a giant Frank in a bun, to stop by the set hours later. In the middle of the night, in front of the cameras, I danced with a big stuffed wiener in Midtown. By the way, in 1983, there were no healthy hot dogs. Not even Nathan's ever made that claim. One exceptional late summer afternoon in New York, I decided to take my hair and makeup people and their spouses out to lunch before we started shooting more scenes that evening. We went to the famous River Cafe, which is at the base of the Brooklyn Bridge, overlooking the East River with stunning views of the Manhattan skyline. I looked across the restaurant, and there, sitting alone in a corner table, was Barney Rosenzweig. I smiled at him. He lifted his glass to me. "Will you excuse me a moment?" I asked my guests. I walked over to Barney's corner table. "Why are you alone? Please come and join us." He turned down my invite. "No, thank you. I'm enjoying the view from here." He said it in a professional manner, but I could tell from his smile that I was the view to which he referred, not the Brooklyn Bridge. He was drinking a martini from a small stemmed cocktail glass and offered me a sip. I could see when I handed back the glass that my one sip drained half of his drink. I knew he would only have one cocktail as we were all still working that day. I went back to my guests, called the waiter over, and said, "Would you please send Mr. Rosenzweig another martini?" My love affair with martinis began that day and ended decades later with my final drink made with perfect Hendrix gin. I've never had to swear off Nathan's hot dogs, though. No one ever complained to me the next day about my unsuitable behavior and memory loss after having a Nathan's. There's a Nathan's hot dog stand in the American Airlines terminal in Miami. I will leave for the airport 45 minutes early to be certain I have time to get one. However, it will never be as delicious as a very dry Hendrix martini.